Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
As unlikely as this may sound, singer-songwriter James Blunt has written one of the funniest books of the year. And if you've ever been trolled online, he has a few tips on how to deal with it. Good afternoon, James.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, very well indeed. Thank you.
James, most people will know you, of course, for Your Beautiful and the album Beyond Bedlam, which was massive selling UK, the biggest selling UK album of the decade in the 2000s, wasn't it? You were massive, like, weren't you?
Yeah, for me, Ireland, where I spent a lot of my time doing it as well, I mean, it was really receptive as a place acoustically driven music.
Yeah. You were around 30 when that happened, so I suppose it wasn't exactly overnight success. How did you handle success?
It's a strange thing, definitely. It takes you by surprise. You know, getting into a nightclub for free was all I'd imagine it was going to be about, and I was happy for that.
Yeah.
But with the things that come along with that, the kind of, you know, the visibility, the fame, I suppose, all that terrible word celebrity is something I wasn't very comfortable with, because I think there are people who are just simply more important in the world and should be celebrated more, like doctors and nurses and teachers and aid workers. So I've always been slightly uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, but you did go to the nightclubs, in fairness, didn't you?
I certainly did, yes.
Yes. So look, the song and the album, obviously loved by millions, but this thing developed where you did get a fair amount of slagging. Did it surprise you, the amount of slagging that you and the song got at the time?
Yeah, definitely. You know, because I thought if you don't like a song, you just don't listen to a song. But I think, you know, and also it's just, I suppose, if you put your head above the parapet, you're going to get shot at, aren't you? So one should expect it in a way, but it does come as a surprise. And also what I suppose is weird is how we as humans can't help ourselves but focus on that, on those negatives. So I can be playing to 20,000 people each night on a tour, you know, of a world tour, and playing 260 concerts in a year. And yet in an interview, I'm always asked, hey, you know, what do you feel about these two negative comments I found online? That seems to be an ongoing process for journalists to talk about, but even for artists too. We went by our nature focus on the negative rather than just be grateful for all the thousands of people who are buying our albums and turning up to your shows.
Yeah, and look, I hasten to add, I'm not focusing on the negative here, but it will become clear when people see what the book is about, why this is relevant to the story. Before we come to that, I think wasn't part of the slagging was because you were viewed as being kind of posh, and you are a bit posh, aren't you? And people held that against you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a difference between a snob and being posh.
Yeah.
I just have a really, really ridiculous accent, which I totally blame my parents for. I'm guilty as charged.
Yeah, and I suppose in pop music as well, it's kind of more chic to be working class or working class acting, isn't it?
Totally. By all accounts, I'm definitely the least cool person in the music business. And I know that.
But equally, it never bothered you, I sense. Yeah. On the poshness, there's one thing I am intrigued by. So when Princess Beatrice caught Ed Sheeran's ear with a sword one time.
That's allegedly, you must say.
Allegedly. OK. You were central to this, weren't you?
There are different stories, aren't there? That, well, what I know is that that I was very close to being knighted, wasn't I?
if indeed it ever happened, yes.
As close as I'll ever get to it.
Okay. You know that thing of that you say kind of quite proudly, you were very uncool and everything. I always feel that the best revenge is to live a good life. And like, you did live a good life. My main exposure to you would have been seeing you having a great time out in Ibiza and just enjoying yourself, didn't you?
I've been really, really lucky. I'm calling you from Ibiza now, actually. And I did my lockdown out here. My tour was cancelled halfway through, and I came out to Ibiza and, you know, to sit here and live lockdown. I've been very fortunate. And I've had great fun with it.
Yeah. So what do you have a small apartment in some kind of a complex out in Ibiza?
Almost, yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to
understand. Did you spring for a two-bedroom or is it just a one-bedroom?
Something very similar. I mean, I did do lockdown with my mother-in-law, and that was 68 days, 11 hours and 36 minutes. So I do deserve a little bit of a medal.
Yeah. So what was lockdown like in Ibiza?
We had a slightly tougher one than back home in the UK, in that we weren't allowed out for the hour's exercise. I don't know what it was like in Ireland. I don't know if you were allowed out for an hour.
We generally were, yeah, even at the worst of it.
So we weren't allowed to do that. But you know, I do have space. I have a garden and a
come
place
on,
to
say
go
it. You had a pool on the premises as well, I bet.
You know, and a forest back at the back where I can dig a shallow grave for the mother-in-law if I need it.
Okay, and then so you've kind of gone back out there now, and you're decamped out there for the time being until all this blows over.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it's a good place to be.
Yeah, yeah. Now listen, so the negative comments and everything. Let's talk about how you dealt with that. And you know, it's such a common thing that people say. That, you know, people in the public eye say there could be a thousand good things and then they read one bad comment and that's what they obsess about. And then what a lot of people do is they decide, OK, I just need to ignore it all. But you've waded in there and engaged with it, basically, haven't you? Because you started on Twitter and just tell me how you operate on Twitter.
Well, I think it started when I put out my music and I would do these interviews, and my songs can be quite earnest if you see them in a particular way. And the interviews I did, if I made a joke, the interviewer never put the ha-ha after my joke. And so my interviews came across as really earnest too. And so I really struggled with that. And then they invented Twitter. And for me, that was the first time I could have a direct voice. But with Twitter, you do see, you know, what humans are like when they try and interact without kind of, you know, without being face to face, without responsibility, where they can just voice their opinions. And people are really, really pretty horrid to each other on Twitter. So, you know, I saw this, but I'd just been given this voice to reply. So rather than just, you know, not reply, I thought I'll write back. But rather than getting some kind of childish tittle-tattle, I thought I'd just laugh at the whole thing, yeah. Laugh at myself for even reading it, because I'm playing these concerts and I'm having an amazing time and having great fun, and yet why am I spending my time reading the negative comments? So I thought I'd just write back, taking the mickey out of myself, and it kind of just took off, really.
Yeah, and you've written a book now. It's kind of, I suppose, a part memoir through Twitter, if you will, and a part kind of social media user manual. And it's called How to Be a Complete and Utter Blunt, a Diary of a Reluctant Social Media Sensation. And I have to say, James, I had such a laugh at the book. I wasn't familiar with your Twitter. I'd seen the odd one, but it is very, very, very funny book. So how would you describe it for people?
Thank you for saying so. I think it's a terrible, it's terrible, and don't give it to any grown up or parents in any way. It's a book specifically to be read on the loo, which during these global pandemic times is very useful in case you missed out on getting loo roll during the last round of panic buying. It's just a book full of obscene interactions with me and other people online, where they've fired something vaguely rude in my direction, and I've responded in the most base kind of way. So it's probably nothing to be proud of.
I think it absolutely is. I think it could be the thing you're remembered for, that and your music, obviously. Listen, did you find it weird at the beginning then when you went on Twitter and all these people who didn't know you or know anything about you wanted to be really mean to you? Does it hurt at the start?
I don't think it hurt, because, you know, these aren't people I'm going to meet. And I think, you know, it just comes as a surprise that people can feel so vitriolic that they need to voice this opinion about something. You know, lots of people, Coldplay are a hugely successful band, and I think they're really incredible and musicians, and I love masses of their songs. And yet, if you read online about Coldplay, it seems fashionable and trendy to say negative things about them. And I think it seems like people doing that are doing it for you know, for how people might perceive them, rather than actually genuinely not liking Coldplay. And you know, if you don't like Coldplay, just don't whine about it. Just listen to something else.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I don't expect you to know your replies here, but I do want to give people a flavour of some of the book. But if you remember any of the replies, you can give them to me. So somebody tweeted, "Can we take a moment to remember how awful James Blunt was?" Do you remember?
No. Do you remember? I have a new album coming out soon.
Okay. Does anyone else hate James Blunt's voice? Someone said. And you said, "I never liked the sound of my own voice until it made me rich."
Ah, yes, of course.
Someone said, "Does James Blunt still exist?" You replied,
"Only in only places you can't get into."
Yeah, exactly. To the tweet, somebody tweeted, "You had an annoying face." You replied, "And no mortgage." Excellent. There aren't all kind of randomers out there on Twitter either. You've kind of had spats with, I suppose, some of the kind of cooler end of the music industry people as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the industry, I suppose you're asked questions about people in interviews, and it's very easy then to be negative about them. And I suppose that a gang of bands and musicians have done that for publicity along the way. You know, the Gallagher brothers, Noel and Liam, have made a profession of saying negative things about other musicians because it keeps them in the media. That if you meet them, actually, they're face to face. They're much nicer. Maybe it means they're cowardly face to face. But I think they do it for press and publicity. But yes, you do have those kind of spats in the business between.
When the Gallaghers met you, do you reckon they thought this guy could probably take us because you were in the army and stuff? Could you take the Gallaghers, do you think, one at a time, like?
We could probably slap each other. I think we're musicians.
Yeah.
Guys, we're all just musicians. We'll be slapping each other around the face in the most pathetic way. It's all bravado and it's all bragging and they're much more delicate than they imply.
Yeah. Damon Albarn and Paul Weller as well have had goals.
They're sweet.
Good man. Now, the thing is, in terms of how this works, you've got a whole book out of these tweets, but my understanding is you don't actually use Twitter that much. That you just go in now and again and search for abuse of yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer the real world. And so I normally go on about once a month and flick through, you know, the last month's tweets and see if anything's, you know, worth fishing for.
So has this in a way managed to neutralize this for you? So clearly you're able to go in there, search out the nastiest tweets about yourself, and it's not bothering you anymore now that you've kind of taken control. Is that it?
Well, you know what I really do feel has been great is that, as I say, when I first put music out, that's all I was known for, and everyone thought I was this very serious, earnest person, and I guess now people will come up and say, "Hey, you know, I don't like your music, but I do, but I love your Twitter," and so at least they know that there's a human being behind these rather effeminate songs that I put out.
Do you think that songs are effeminate?
I don't, but that's the way I'll describe them for you.
Do you ever wonder then, you see, like the thing is, anyone who's taking their time to tweet something mean about a person they don't know, presumably like they're possibly a kind of a sad person without a lot going on in their lives. Do you ever think that, like, you know, they tweet that in some moment of whatever, bitterness or whatever, and suddenly they get hit over the head by, like, James Blunt actually comes back and in front of all your masses of followers and tweets them back, that it might actually kind of hurt them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, hopefully most of my answers are with humour and often taking the mickey out of myself. But what I often do is I'll follow that person, you know, and then I'll direct message them and I'll say, "Hey, you know, I hope you're okay. And, you know, it's all in good humor and I'm taking the mickey out of myself as much as you. And if people pile on and you find it difficult, then, you know, you can at least point out that we're following each other and we're in conversation and it's all done in a friendly manner."
I love it. So you basically provide an after tweet support service for people after you've come back into their lives, after you've come into their lives and destroyed them temporarily. Yeah. Wow. Excellent. And listen, there's so many strange strands to your story. The book is dedicated to Carrie Fisher. Tell me about you and Carrie Fisher.
I lived with Carrie Fisher throughout my recording of the last five albums, and sadly she died when I was recording my sixth. And I lived in a house in Beverly Hills. I recorded Goodbye, My Lover in her bathroom, and she's godmother to my eldest child. And she's the most incredible, creative human being. Words were her passion, which is why you know, my first book should be dedicated to her. And she's just the most incredible human being. Back to Bedlam was named really because of the madness of living in that house while being reflective on your own place and position in life. She's been a huge, huge influence, and she was an amazing woman.
Yeah, she was. I was lucky enough to meet her once, and she's an extraordinarily charming, entertaining and everything person, but she was a complicated person as well to get on with, wasn't she?
I got on with her incredibly well. Complicated in her mind that she was, I guess people would think she was, you know, almost touching on madness, but in fact she was hugely intelligent, and she was just skipped through and between subjects so quickly that sometimes it was hard to keep up. But no, I think always incredibly easy to get on with.
Okay. In terms of your background, we mentioned your army background. Tell us a bit about that. How long were you in the army and how active were you?
I was in the army for 6 years. I was a reconnaissance officer in the Life Guards, part of the Household Cavalry Regiment. So my job is to creep around in bushes, stalking people, which is kind of what I've done
really?
As a musician.
And You're Beautiful is kind of a slightly stalky kind of song in a way, isn't it?
Basically a professional stalker and paid for by Her Majesty's government and contingent in my professional life as a musician. But yeah, so and the operations I was on was in Kosovo in 1999.
And did that toughen you up then and prepare you to have a bit of perspective when you became something as frivolous as a musician?
Yeah, definitely. Whenever I thought I was having a tough time, then, you know, to speak to my uncle or my cousin or my friends who might be in Afghanistan or Iraq really put things in perspective.
Yeah, there's people texting in here. One is saying James Blunt is a psychological genius. That's according to Anne in Dublin 13. Noel James says that, do you not know the reason people, mostly men, dislike you was really because they didn't trust him with their women with all those smoochy songs? Do you think that's a bit of it? Is a bit of male jealousy going on there?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think weirdly, my record label genuinely marketed that first album towards women rather than, you know, I wrote the songs as a man questioning, you know, my own place in the world, leaving the army and stepping out. And I think the marketing was very much focused on women. And when I think that was to cut out 50%, and I don't think that was necessarily helpful.
OK, James, it's been fantastic talking to you. Do you see yourself back touring anytime soon? Can you imagine a load of people together in an arena or whatever?
I mean, I really have picked the wrong business, haven't I? Being a musician is all about bringing people together, strangers standing shoulder to shoulder, and that's exactly what a pandemic doesn't work in that environment. And my other job, last a couple of years ago, I bought a pub in London, and that's exactly the same thing. Like, okay, you know, those two businesses are the wrong ones right now. But yes, there's, you know, the vaccine's been approved. It's on its way. And we have just started putting our old dates that were postponed back in the diary and putting new dates in the diary too. And we really hope that we'll be kicking off the tour back again in May 2021.
Okay, fantastic. And good luck with that. And look, definitely, James Blunt, if it doesn't work out, you have a great future with the old Twitter books anyway. Listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And How to Be a Complete and Utter Blunt, Diary of a Reluctant Social Media Sensation is out now, and it's published by Little Brown.
Email brendan@rte.ie.